Hello, Internet. Welcome to episode 91 of the Assorted Calibers podcast, a Second Amendment podcast. There's a little bit for everyone. I'm Weirdbeard, and with me as always is my wonderful hostess, Erin Paulette. How are you doing, Erin?
It's Paulette, not Paulette.
That's pretty close to what I said. I think I just accented the wrong syllable. I beg your pardon.
Yeah, I've got a friend like that who puts the wrong emphasis on the wrong syllable. And it's just... I think half the time he does it deliberately, but I think the other half the time he does it just because he's an avid reader and hasn't heard it pronounced. And I don't know whether he's, to use the slang term, taking the piss or not. Mm-hmm. And I just sort of twitch. It's like, this is not the hill I want to die on. Twitch, twitch, twitch. But anyway, normally it's not a big deal, but because you were giving me problems before we started, I just wanted to go with, no, it's Paulette, not Paulette. Paulette.
Erin Paulette. P-U-H. She is a small lady, and she's compacted into a small thing with a gel coating. She's time release. Well, there. This show's officially gone completely silly.
I'm just glad you didn't take it to the one place where I thought you were going to take it.
Yeah, we can save that for later when you can tell me. I don't want to know.
I don't want you to know either.
Yeah, it's probably smart for everybody.
All right, how am I? I'm good. I'm mostly recovered from my trip. Although I'm still a little bit tired. It's really kind of remarkable how much it takes out of me. And I don't know if it would just take it out of anyone or if it's that, well, I'm middle-aged now, and this takes me longer to bounce back. So that's fun. March is actually pretty light for me, which is good, because I'm going to be crazy busy. I was going to be crazy busy in April. Now I'm not so sure, because, well, we were talking about the NRA convention, and while I think it's still going to happen, there's the not slim possibility that it will be canceled, because there's already been one big convention canceled, the American Physical Society. So we're recording this on Monday, the 2nd of March. The American Physical Society, the largest physics meeting of the year, set to be held in Denver, Colorado, was canceled. And they expected 10,000 attendees. Now, Weird, do you have a ballpark of how many people attended the NRA annual meeting last year?
I think it was just under 80,000.
Wow. Okay, that's actually more. I remember hearing the word 55,000 bandied about somewhere. It may have been a previous one. But it's much, much bigger than the APS March meeting. And so, you know, it's not a trivial concern here. This might actually happen, depending on what happens in the United States now that we have confirmed cases here in the U.S. And so, because I understand that there are a lot of people who are concerned about coronavirus or COVID-19, I would like to refer you to a guest article that was published on Blue Collar Prepping last week. If you are a fan of mine, if you are a follower, you already know about it. But in case you're one of those weird, strange people who only listen to the show for Weirdbeard, I want you to go give it a try. It's in the show notes, and it's titled Pandemic, Don't Panic, and it is written by a very dear friend of mine, Dr. Kathleen Madsen. Now, I've known Kathy since the early 90s. We went to college together. She is one of the smartest people I know. And hopefully that says something, because while I don't bill myself as being particularly smart, I know that I'm not dumb either. And I like to surround myself with very smart people. And just to give you an idea of what she's talking about, all right, so she's not a medical doctor, but she has a PhD in bioscience with a concentration in microbiology and infectious disease. So she knows what she's talking about. And while I understand that a lot of people are concerned, what you need to realize is that the media is sensationalizing this, because It's what people are interested in hearing about right now. So, of course, they're going to breathlessly report everything because that's what it does. I've got a term for it. Mediabation. Media masturbation. They are furiously wanking about COVID and they'll do it to get ratings. And I want people to take a breath, to read this article, to realize that it's not the end of the world. Or, you know, I'll even hedge and say, not yet. Things might change. I don't think they will, but I will allow the possibility. But just observe basic hygiene. Wash your hands. Don't touch your face. Don't touch people if you don't have to. Don't go out if you don't have to. Lay in some supplies. I'm a prepper. So, you know, okay, if you're a prepper, you should have at least a month's worth of food and medicine and other things in your house. If you don't, you know, prep like it's a snowstorm. You know, go out and get like a week or two of things and just try to wait this out, because there's a lot of panic over the mortality rates. And I understand why, because, you know, compared to the flu, the rates are very, very high. But what people are missing is that you are looking at rates spread across an entire population, and there's no breakdown by demographic. And so if you look at it in terms of age, you will see that the younger you are, the greater chance you have of surviving it. Now, weird, you and I, okay, we haven't hit 50, mm-hmm. but some of us can see it more easily than others. For you and I, we have like under 0.5% of dying from coronavirus. And those are spectacularly good odds. It goes up according to age. And so, like, if you're in your 70s, you have an 8% chance of dying, which is not as good. But another way to look at it is you've got a 92% survival rate. So just keep these things in mind. And of course, if you have other diseases like a heart condition, diabetes, whatever, of course it will be a complication. But people are selling this like, well, honestly, like it's the next Ebola. And look, I blogged about this in 2014. Was it 2014? Was it 2016? It was one of those when there was a case of Ebola in the United States in Dallas because somebody had brought it over, and people were going nuts, freaking out about it and about how it was going to be the end of the world. And guess what? It didn't happen, because we have good infrastructure, because we have good hygiene. And, well, as much as you may hate social media, it's a good way of spreading good information as well as bad information. And so what I'm saying is that this is not the time to panic. And I have every faith that coronavirus is going to pass with about as much fanfare as the Ebola virus did. We're going to be okay. But people like to be worried. I think maybe fear can be addictive, which is why a lot of people enjoy watching scary movies, or why when there's something stressful, you've just got to watch the news. And so I think that there's going to be a lot more sensationalism. And that could result in things like the NRA annual meeting getting canceled. So we're going to see. But I want to reassure people, it's not going to be that bad.
I think that's some good advice. And also,
thank you.
The advice in the article, let me see if I can actually get the exact quote just so I get it just right, is your second stop is the grocery store, where you grab a couple of bottles of cough syrup and Tylenol, maybe a week's worth of easy prep meal staples like lunch meat, peanut butter, micro dinners, good old bleach and Lysol. You should probably pick up an extra bottle of wine or a six pack, because reasons. And so I spent my weekend up in Maine, and on my way back from Maine, there's a place called New Hampshire, which is the wonderful theme park to my life, called the New Hampshire State Liquor Store. And I, as part of the advice of this article and your dear friend, I picked up an obscene amount of booze, because reasons. And you know what? It made me feel better.
Well, good.
But yeah, so... So yeah, we will see if the whole thing gets canceled. That would suck, but at the same time, if there's a disease being spread around, you know what? Even if it's not that deadly, I don't want to catch it. It's no fun. No one wants to get sick.
No, of course not.
No one wants con funk.
Yeah, the SHOT Show con crud is legendary. Mm-hmm. And that's just the con crud. So, you know, okay, segue, but relevant. When I was at Life, the Universe, and Everything, there was a panel involving colonization of the outer planets. And we had some very interesting people there. A medical doctor and someone who had a degree in environmental science. And they said that in any population that is large enough to count as a colony, I mean, it won't be like a research base, but and this is taken from actual data from, you know, Antarctic workers who essentially live in a space outpost. It's just, it doesn't need to be oxygen tight, but everything else, it's very isolated. It's got the deadly cold. So they were using a lot of extrapolation from there, but they were saying in any population that's suitable enough to be a colony, there's always going to be someone who has some degree of crud, and you will never get rid of it, and it's just going to move from person to person. And I thought that was interesting and kind of horrifying that, you know, in a particular colony, there's always going to be someone who is sick and there's nothing you can do about it. And so, that's the SHOT Show con crud. And, you know, in any given population, someone's going to have it. It's going to spread. Just recognize that some people will be sick, but unless you are elderly or immunocompromised or have something wrong with you, it's only going to mildly suck, I think. We've got like a guy here in the United States who has it, and right now he's saying, well, the only treatment they have for me is Gatorade, mm-hmm. and I'm staying hydrated. And, you know, it kind of sucks, but it's okay. So,
yep.
I know, I've taken over the conversation again. I think we've beat this into the ground.
Oh, definitely. So why don't we shift some gears into... There's not really a whole lot to talk about on this one. There's a little bit, but I just thought I saw this pop up this morning, and it was being actually Sean Sorrentino. I saw it from him first because it's in out of North Carolina, but it's a story of a person walked into a convenience store and was going to rob it and was essentially collected all the patrons of the store behind the register. It looks like it's one of those ones where it has the, I don't know if it's bulletproof glass, but it's got the enclosed register area of the store. And the guy had essentially was dragging everyone back there to contain them. And as he was pulling people in, another patron walked into the store and saw what was going on and shot him a whole bunch of times. And, you know what? Well, the only thing that's not a happy ending on it is it sounds like the guy shot the person and then walked away. And I have yet to hear if they've actually found out who this person was. It's very clearly justifiable force because he had a gun and he was roughly handling people and dragging them into a place against their will. So one would assume that he was doing all that. He had intentions to use the gun if need be. I don't think that there's that. I mean, there's always could be a question. This could be someone who carries a gun not legally and so therefore did not want to, even though their actions were legal, that the circumstances of their actions were not.
Yeah, that was the first thing that crossed my mind.
Yeah. And so, yeah, that's a story. And of course, I really just wanted to publish it only because I've read John Blott's book, The Bias Against Guns. And yeah, just talking about how much the news, yeah, they're just not going to talk about this story. They'll talk about a whole bunch of other weird and wacky stories. Everybody heard about the person who killed somebody else for the Popeye's chicken sandwich. But this story is not going to get nearly the legs that foolish story got. But yeah, and I just thought I'd the only other thing that I had to bring up was The Cornered Cat by Kathy Jackson. She has a section called Personal Boundaries. And it reminded me of this. This one is one of those like, oh boy. I mean, this, her whole website is something that you should read. She also has a book out that, that I got. That's a lot of the stuff on the website, but I still think it's worth a read. But she said, some of my personal boundaries are, I will not go anywhere at gunpoint. If a bad guy wants me to go somewhere else, it is because he will be able to do something to me there that he is unwilling or unable to do with to me right here, right now. Therefore, no matter how bad the tactical situation seems right here and now is the absolute best chance I have to fight back I will ever have, and I intend to use it. I will not be tied up. If a bad guy wants to tie me up, it's because he wants to do things to me that I would be able to prevent if I was not tied up. Therefore, I resist while I'm still able to do so. I will not kneel. No one is going to execute me. If I die, I'll die fighting. And if someone tries to take one of my children, I will fight. And I'm not going to bother reading that one because that gets a little dark. But the bottom line is that, yeah, if someone's trying to take away one of your children, it's just like if a bad person is trying to relocate you, you're in a bad situation and it's only going to get worse. And so it reminded me of that on the, he's moving all these people around and doing all that. It's just one of those, like, this is not going to get better for them. So I'm very glad that the person stepped in, and you know what, even if they weren't legally carrying or even necessarily quote unquote a good person, this person might have been a gangbanger or a drug dealer or you name whatever undesirable member of society. Yet not everybody is, you know, pure evil. The everyone is capable of great good, and this was a great good. And of course, the store owner was like, oh, I hate to see an 18-year-old kid get gunned down, and I can sympathize with the statement. But I've got to say, robbing convenience stores and holding people at gunpoint is really, really easy not to do. I do it every day. And to make deliberate choices like that, I mean, it's not just something that happens. So you make bad choices, you win bad prizes.
So there are two things I want to point out. First of all, The Cornered Cat, A Woman's Guide to Concealed Carry, is available on Amazon. There's a link in the show notes. You can get the paperback for $20, or you can get it on Kindle for like $7. Or, hey, it's actually an audiobook, and you can get it for like $17.50. So, you know, I encourage people to get this book, and if it doesn't apply to you, then pass it on to someone in your life who is, you know, considering concealed carry. Secondly, the other thing that I found interesting in that video, the person they interviewed, I don't know if he was the manager, the assistant manager, someone who was there but wasn't there during the robbery, he was very obviously open carrying a pistol.
Oh, I didn't notice that. But yeah, I believe that guy's actually the owner.
you didn't notice that, huh? Okay. And so I thought it was really interesting. Well, first of all, that the news actually showed it. Mm-hmm. And secondly, there's sort of that unspoken, you know, other people here in the store also carry. And if the customer hadn't shot you, maybe one of the employees would have.
Yeah.
So that was also very deterring. And I like that.
I must say, in my own defense, as a general rule, I'm used to when a news camera sees someone who's open carrying, the news is always like, yeah, take it out, let me have a look at it, and always ends up with like some sort of horrible cringeworthy thing of somebody doing something unsafe for the sake of good theatrics. And clearly they didn't make a big deal of it because it's North Carolina. One other news story that Aaron, you showed to me, and I'm like, yeah, we're just gonna talk about it just briefly. We don't need to get too much into politics, but at the same time, any politics that involve Michael Bloomberg is Second Amendment politics.
Yeah, he's your favorite candidate, the one you love to hate.
That's right. Do you want to talk about the story?
You know, I do not want to take away the pleasure that I know you will get from talking about this, so go ahead.
Yes, well, it appears that Michael Bloomberg went to Selma. Of course, we're recording this the Monday before Super Tuesday, and He went to the historic Brown Chapel AME Church in Selma, Alabama, I assume as part of a campaign stop to raise his awareness within the black community and show how much he cares about civil rights. We'll get to that in a little bit. But it appears that his reputation preceded him, and several members of the church stood up and turned their back while he was giving his speech.
And the reason for this, for people who didn't immediately see the connection, is because Bloomberg both initiated and defended stop and frisk, which was pointed out to disproportionately affect black people and other minorities. Mm-hmm. And so for someone who was the instigator and defender of a very prejudicial police tactic to go to Selma, which is... You know, I will confess my knowledge of the civil rights movement is not great. I don't know if that's where it began or if it was just a very important point. But the fact is, he went there, he went to a black church, he had the temerity to do this, mm-hmm. and a lot of people in the congregation just said, nope, not gonna happen. And they stood up in their pews and they turned their back on him.
Yeah. Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what happens on the Super Tuesday. Of course, you listening along, you already know what's going to happen. But people are talking about, oh, you know, Bloomberg's throwing so much money at all the ads. And I mean, again, as I've said before, he's probably buying ad space in your dreams right now. It was very amusing for me watching YouTube coverage of the first debate where Elizabeth Warren was just going on and on about his sexual harassment of his employees and all the non-disclosure agreements and things like that. And Bloomberg just uncomfortably squirming at trying to spin it in such a way to make himself look charitable. And next thing you know, up pops an ad for Mike Bloomberg is for women. Michael, get it done. And it's just one of those like, oh, really? It's just, I mean, it just it just couldn't be more ironic. And so we shall see. But again, don't need to dive too deep into the politics of it, but just let's just note that all Mike Bloomberg politics is Second Amendment podcast because Second Amendment politics because yeah, he is the anti-gun lobby.
And we want to see him lose so very badly. And not just lose, but lose dirty, lose painfully. Lose in such a way that it's like his ego is crushed and he will never return to his former levels of self-aggrandizement.
I would love to see a Tammy Faye Baker a style concession speech. Kids ask your folks. I'm gonna put a video of that in the show notes. If you don't know what I'm talking about, go in the show notes and click on that because, oh, I remember seeing that as a kid going, oh my goodness.
We do try to keep this podcast politically neutral, but he's such an anti-2A candidate that we've just got to kick him every chance we get. Mm-hmm. But changing the topic, David continues his series about the anatomy of ammunition. This week, he gives us a primer on primers.
Hi, and welcome to Gun Lovers and Other Strangers. In response to Weird and Aaron's comments about my last segment, this one is an overview of the differences between, and history of, the Boxer and Berdan priming systems. These priming systems were both developed around the same time, in the mid-1860s, and both are forms of centerfire primers. With both of these priming systems, the firing process is identical. The firing pin strikes the base of the primer cup. This compresses the priming compound against the anvil, which causes it to detonate. The resulting explosion travels through the flash hole, igniting the powder, which generates a large quantity of gas, forcing the bullet down the barrel. The devil, as always, is in the details. The Berdan primer, which is much more commonly used in Europe and other foreign countries, was developed by famed inventor and U.S. Army General Hiram Berdan. This, by the way, is the same General Berdan who, during the American Civil War, formed two regiments of marksmen specially trained and equipped with Sharps rifles. They became known as Berdan's sharpshooters. The distinctive characteristics of the Berdan priming system are that the primer pocket in the cartridge case contains the anvil that the priming compound is crushed against to fire the cartridge, and multiple flash holes that are offset around the perimeter of the primer pocket. The primer itself is a simple copper or alloy cup containing the priming compound and a sealing element of top, often made of foil. The main benefit of Berdan primers is that the primers themselves are considerably simpler to manufacture. This helps explain their popularity throughout the world. However, this is somewhat outweighed by the more involved process in making the cartridge cases and the greater challenge when reloading. This last part explains their lack of popularity in America, as we are a nation of ardent reloaders. Removing the primer from a Berdan-style case often involves the use of a special tool, which generally damages the primer and is not amenable to automation. While hard to find in the United States, Berdan primers are still being made and do show up occasionally. Just make sure that you get the correct size for your cartridge case. Which brings us to another issue. Over the years, Berdan primers have been available in a dizzying variety of sizes. They're usually listed by diameter in millimeters, but some references also list them by type number. The other main cartridge priming system is the Boxer primer. It was developed by Colonel Edward Boxer, who was superintendent of the Royal Laboratories at the British Royal Arsenal at the time. The Boxer primer is by far the most popular priming system in the United States. Cases made for use with the Boxer priming system have a single, centrally located flash hole, and the anvil is contained within the primer, not part of the case. This means while the primers are somewhat more complicated to manufacture, both case production and reloading are considerably easier. Compared to the number of Berdan primer sizes, the list of Boxer primer types is relatively short, coming in at less than a dozen. There are large and small rifle and pistol primers, which covers most cartridges, plus magnum versions of each for additional ignition power where needed. The 50 BMG case takes its own special primer, and shotgun holes have taken the standard number 209 primer for many years. Occasionally, you might see a magnum version of this, but I haven't come across many. And yes, it is somewhat ironic that the Berdan priming system, which was invented by an officer in the American military, is much more common outside the US, while the Boxer system, which was invented by a British officer in England, is vastly more popular in America. While the two primers are not interchangeable, it is possible to convert Berdan prime cases to the Boxer system. This is not an undertaking to get into lightly. If cases are available that use the Boxer priming system, it is almost always better to get those. Where this makes more sense is if the cases are expensive or hard to get commercially. I'm not going to go into the detail here, but the basic process involves drilling out the primer pocket, drilling through the flash hole, and then swaging the newly cut primer pocket to the standard size appropriate for a large or small primer. That was a much simplified description of the process. More information will follow. On another note, over the years I have spoken to some serious do-it-yourselfers when it comes to reloading, and they brought up another point. There are people out there who recharge primers. By this I mean they'll make their own priming compound, flatten the firing pin dent out of the primer cup, and refill the primer so it can be used again. As I said, they're pretty serious. While the Boxer primer is easier to remove from the case intact, keeping track of the anvil and getting it back in place properly can be a bit of a challenge. With Berdan primed cases, getting the primer cup out intact is considerably more difficult. However, since the anvil is part of the case, refurbishing the primer is considerably easier. Opinions were pretty split over which system was the better option overall for this process. In closing, here's a belated Valentine's Day rhyme for weird. Roses are red, violets are blue. Put my links in the show notes, or I'll have to cut you. That about wraps up this segment. If you have any questions for me or suggestions for future segments, or a comment on a past segment, please post them on the Assorted Calibers Podcast Facebook page, and Aaron or Weird will make sure I get them. That's all for now. Thanks for listening. I'm David, and this is Gun Lovers and Other Strangers.
Oh, man, I remember seeing in a Second Amendment forum people talking about how to reload Berdan primers, and I'm just like, but why? It seems like so much work, and then on top of that, like, where do you even find them? But it's good to know, because especially if you have a bunch of ammunition that you want to reload and you don't check to see what kind of primer it has, your decapping die will snap inside of a Berdan primer, because it'll just hit the bottom of the case and just bend or break.
People reloading primers just in general? Well, you know, I'm a prepper, so that makes sense. Because, okay, if you've got all these reloading things, but then you can't ignite your cartridge, you're kind of screwed. Mm-hmm. And so this is something that's very interesting to me. In fact, when David was talking about reloading, refurbishing, re-whatevering the primers, it actually reminded me of a kit that I saw several years ago at an NRA convention. And it was a kit for reloading 22 long rifle.
Oh, interesting.
And I didn't buy it because it was a little too expensive, and honestly, I don't have the space, let alone the money or the time to get into reloading, but they gave me the informational sheet for free, and I mentioned it somewhere on the Blue Collar Prepping blog, and they actually they detailed the steps, and it was very similar to what he was doing. They didn't mention hammering out the dent, so I guess, you know, you can only use it X number of times until you've, like, completely...
just mashed the rim into oblivion.
Yeah, you know, done something or other to the rim face is where I was going with that. But still, you could get a lot more uses out of it. And mm-hmm. So, you know, just the fact that it's possible is really interesting. It requires a heck of a lot of work. But if you are into reloading for the long haul, yeah, that's definitely something that you need to know how to do, because it might really be useful.
Actually, on a slightly tangential, nerdy reloading note, there was a gentleman at our club who used to actually swaged his own ammunition. So instead of casting his bullets, he would actually cut lead wire into the proper state and then press it into a die and essentially, you know, duct it into a bullet shape. And in that, he could also use copper sheeting, or for certain calibers, he actually was using 22 casings. He would trim the top 22 casings down and actually swage a lead core into it to make jacketed bullets.
Hmm.
It seemed really, really interesting and cool, especially given like how many 22 casings are just floating around on the ground at my gun club, until I looked at the price of a swaging press and went, oh no, I think it was over $1,000, and I'm sure they're more expensive now because that was a long time ago.
So he was just basically cold forging bullets out of wire.
Exactly. Exactly. But also I liked the fact that instead of, you know, if you're casting your own bullets, you're casting bare lead. You know, the mm-hmm. best you're going to do is you can press a gas check into the bottom of them. But to actually make a fully jacketed bullet or a jacketed hollow point, it's really not in the realm of possibility with casting. But with swaging, that's how you can do it, because that's how the ammo companies do it.
Hmm. Yeah, that sounds really neat, but that also sounds really expensive, because I imagine the pressure is just tremendous.
Yeah, the press is quite impressive. I didn't really look too deeply into it. It was literally just saw the sticker shock, knew how much I was paying with ammo, and did the math real, real quick and said, nope.
I assume hydraulics are involved. I'm pretty sure they'd have to be.
Yeah, I've got to imagine. I'll have to look into it. Or maybe, you know what, knowing David probably knows a little bit about swaging, so...
Hey, David. Okay, so for your next Gun Lovers and Other Strangers segment, why don't you talk to us about swaging bullets?
Sounds like a plan.
So speaking of plans, mm-hmm. you have an interview with someone whose life didn't go as planned.
It was posted in a Facebook group. Ian McCullum of Forgotten Weapons did his take on the Mutter's Milk cocktail. And also, I had previously noted that he had mentioned on YouTube that he had worked as a bartender before he was an arms historian and the two-gun match director that we know today. But he didn't mention any more about that. So I sat down with Ian to talk about his time as a bartender. Well, I would like to welcome to the show someone I think we all know. Ian McCollum of Forgotten Weapons and In Range TV. But I wanted to talk to Ian about something that he hasn't really talked about much. You talk a lot about guns, you talk a lot about shooting, you talk about your two-gun matches, but you've mentioned briefly that you used to be a bartender.
Yes. Yes, I was. A couple years, actually.
So can you, I mean, obviously I think many of us saw it. Actually, I got this idea because someone on the Facebook group posted your video of the Mutter's Milk recipe. And I've seen you make a French 75, which of course you had to.
Naturally.
But by the way, have you tried the New Orleans style, which is using cognac instead of a gin?
I have not. I like gin.
Yeah, well, I like gin as well. And I'm starting to grow into cognac, unfortunately for my wallet, but I'm not a huge fan of cognac overall. But let me tell you, the pairing of champagne or sparkling white wine with cognac works surprisingly well. It's a slightly different drink, but it's worth a try.
Okay, interesting.
But back to Bart. Obviously, you know how to mix drinks because we've seen you do it. Tell me about how you got your start as a bartender.
So this is way less glamorous than I think most people expect. Mm-hmm. I had gotten myself a job in Phoenix installing garage doors, which the way it was pitched sounded like a really good opportunity. This company was starting a new program and they needed some people at the ground level who were going to move up and. It sounded great. It worked out not so great. Also, I know this may be a shock for some people to figure out, as it perhaps was to me, but installing garage doors in Phoenix in the summer, not a fun job.
I can only imagine.
So I started looking for something else, basically anything else to do to make some money. And it was like a friend of my parents or something went to bartending school and got a job. And my parents mentioned this to me and I'm like, well, hell, I'll try that. Okay. And I found a little hole in the wall sort of bartending school in Phoenix and went in. I think it was like 6 weeks in the evenings. And by what I understand today, this was like this. Not super cringy, but man, it was not. It was like your average sort of Chili's bartending.
Yeah. Wait, what year was this?
Ooh, this would have been something like 2005.
Okay, so this is towards the tail end of the 90s doldrum of Long Island iced teas and vodka and cranberry school of bartending.
Precisely. Yes, Sex on the Beaches and Cosmopolitans.
Yeah, all sorts of things that are called martinis that have just lots of fruit juice and artificial sweeteners.
And by the way, no one associated with this school, quote unquote, had any recognition that there was such a thing as a cocktail doldrum.
Yes.
That you could have told them that and they'd be like, what? Bartending's a great job. And by the way, I didn't really drink at the time. At all. So this was an interesting choice of work for me.
Oh, that's interesting. I have an equally non-glamorous time as a bartender that I won't, I'll let you, this is your interview, but yeah, literally I actually started bartending at the age of 20. And and I also did not attend, like, I'm curious about the bartending school as well, because I'm like, I'm 20. And I didn't drink until I was 21. I think I had one beer when I was 20 and felt that I was cheating something. Cause I'm like, I can make it. Like I'm only going to drink legal. And, and so, yeah, I said to my, I worked on a tour boat and the tour boat had a very small bar. Literally the bar was, I think about 4 feet long and with very, very minor fixings for cocktail making. And, I said, and everything was in plastic cups. And I said, I'm 20 and I don't drink and I don't have a bartending license, because friends in college all had, like, there were frat houses that I used to go to where they'd have their bartending certificates behind the bar, make it seem like it was a classy drinking establishment. And but I said, I don't drink. He says, look, in the afternoon cruises, there's going to be a lot of dead space. Here's the old Mr. Boston Guide to Bartending. Just read this book when you're bored. And I read that thing cover to cover, and I wish I could have a copy. It was actually, I really enjoyed that book. But,
nice.
But tell me about bartending schools, because I, like I said, I never did it.
So I finished this out. And by the way, most of what they did for actual, like, your practical exam at the end was all done with colored water.
Mm-hmm.
In the appropriate bottles, but you can judge the style of cocktails they were making because you were, you know, the assessment of whether you had done it right was whether you had the right color in the glass at the end, because everything was very colorful. So anyway, I go there 6 weeks, I get my little bartending certificate. And one of the things that had drawn me to this particular school was that they advertised job placement. And sure enough, like 2 days after I graduated, quote unquote, that makes it sound awfully fancy, I get a call from them that, hey, they've got a job opening at the Phoenix airport. And am I interested? And I was out working a job installing a garage door at the time. And so I called up my boss. And this, by the way, this wasn't like residential service call stuff. This was a lot of new home construction. So, you know, we'd go into this subdivision where they had 200 new houses that were in the process of being built. Nobody lives in there. And like, okay, we need to install doors in 100 of these houses. Anyway, I call my boss from the job site. I'm like, yeah, after I finish this one, I have to take the rest of the afternoon off. And he's like, no, you don't. I'm like, well, I really do. He's like, well, if you take the rest of the afternoon off, don't bother coming back in again. And I went, okay, because this job really sucked.
I'm uncomfortable with that.
I ditched it and headed over to a job interview at the Phoenix airport, got hired. Actually, I think the interview was at some office building somewhere, because it was with HMS Host, which is the gigantic food service conglomerate that services most of the airports in the U.S. And they hired me on the spot, like, you have the certificate, you meet our standards. And I ended up bartending at an airport Chili's for 3 years.
Ooh, a Chili's.
Mm-hmm.
At first, I was thinking it was like one of those terminal bars that you see. But tell us about that experience.
Well, it's in some ways actually it was a fantastic job for me because I was in the airport, but I was outside of security. For folks who are familiar with the Phoenix airport, this was Terminal 3. And the restaurant's no longer there. They closed it up several years after I left. But we were outside. We were the only bar outside security. So I didn't have to go through security on a daily basis, which was really nice. Anyone who had a seriously long delay and wanted to go outside and smoke and drink, we were their only option for drinking in that terminal without going back through security over and over. It was an airport. So we closed at like 10 p.m. I'm not exactly a party animal, and it would have been seriously disruptive to my life to try and be working a typical bar shift where I'm going home at 2 or 3 or 4 in the morning. Well, this wasn't. Like, I went home at 11 every night. Never had to deal with drunk drivers, really, because you're at an airport. You're not driving. We obviously had to deal with drunk people from time to time, but you don't have, you know, we didn't have bums coming into the bar because we're in an airport. It was really actually a pretty sweet gig. And everything was overpriced, which means percentage-based tips were also, a little higher than they normally would have been.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. So now the downside was it was incredibly boring. I'm not a huge people person. So, working in the food service industry front of house was not the most conducive thing to my own personality, but the money was actually surprisingly good, especially for as young as I was at the time. I took on every extra shift I could get to make more money. And I used that to pay off my student loans from my engineering technology degree.
Oh, that's a great American success story. And also I gotta say, as someone who's seen me make craft cocktails and heard me on Handgun Radio doing the drink segments every week or just about every week and all that, people have always said, "Oh man, you should really like think about like taking up a shift as a bartender." Well, no, I mean, number one, I'm a morning person. I definitely would not do well with, and my daughter is a morning person, which is the more important fact. I would not do well with sweeping up at 2 a.m. and then however long it takes me to get home.
Yeah.
But also, as someone who enjoys making craft cocktails, Ian, what would you say about the craft cocktail experience at a Chili's in an airport?
I would say you're not going to get one. The vast majority of what I made were Bloody Marys and Micheladas, which I despise. largely because of that experience. And Chili's had 6 or 8 specialty quote unquote margaritas. And it's kind of funny, kind of cringy looking back. Like, I did my damnedest to try and convince people that, hey, you know, you could try a margarita that doesn't have sweet and sour mix and just has lime juice. I know it sounds weird. And probably 50% of the very small number of people I managed to convince to try this were seriously put off when they got a drink that wasn't a giant pitcher.
Yeah. You know,
what the hell? This thing's tiny. Well, yes, it's supposed to be. Yeah, it... And by the way, we didn't have lime juice. We had sweet and sour mix behind the bar. We had limes for lime wedges. And so anytime I was able to actually convince someone to do that, I'd go through, you know, squeezing out like 18 lime wedges to get an ounce of lime juice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. For those that don't know, a true margarita is tequila. Do you put simple in yours or agave syrup? I don't do it with mine. I make mine a little less sweet. Yeah. Triple sec though. I like elderflower. Elderflower really makes a good margarita. And lime juice. And then, yeah, you just shake that up, you know, serve it up or on the rocks. And, you know, you can add salt, you can add bitters to jazz it up. But in my day of bartending in the late 90s, early 2000s you would take a large glass and you would pour one shot of tequila at the bottom of it. And then you would grab a neon yellow container. And
yep.
You fill the glass with ice, pour a shot of tequila into it, get a neon yellow container that says margarita mix and fill it up.
Yeah, that's pretty much
it. It is the same as how I used to make Tom Collins's. It was a Tom Collins, which is watch Ian's French 75 video and just simply substitute the champagne for sparkling water and you have a Tom Collins. You pour gin into a glass filled with ice and then fill it up with something that says Collins mix on it. Ta-da! Yeah.
Which is the same as margarita mix. It's high fructose corn syrup and like yellow number 5.
Yeah, exactly. It's all sorts of stuff that it was made in DuPont, Delaware.
So I basically learned to drink and developed a taste for classic cocktails at home on my own after I got off of work and virtually never applied it at work because it just no one goes to Chili's looking for a classic cocktail, especially not at an airport. And it wasn't the popular thing that has become now.
Yeah.
So in fact, it's kind of funny. I haven't really kept up with it all that much. My go-to book is the book that honestly I bought back at that point, which is Vintage Spirits and Forgotten Cocktails by Ted Haig. And I love that book. Are you familiar with it?
I actually don't think I've actually seen that one, but I'm going to put a link to it in the show notes.
I think it's fantastic. I found a couple of personal favorites in there, and it's basically all Prohibition era stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny looking back on it now. He talks about a lot of ingredients that are really hard to get. Like, you know, there's only one manufacturer that makes elderflower liqueur, and you like may have to mail order it from out of state. And orange bitters, like, ooh, what do you have to do to find orange bitters? And a lot of this stuff now, there's, you know, I can go to my local generic big box liquor store and there's 4 different varieties of all this stuff. Yeah. Which is really cool.
I buy my orange bitters at the grocery store.
Yeah, exactly. Like Angostura makes orange bitters now. I still have my bottle of Reagan's orange bitters.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was only recently that Saint Germain actually started getting imported into the United States. And then shortly after that, it's actually made here in Somerville, Massachusetts. And I highly recommend if you can find it is a company makes a version called Saint Elder, which I actually think is considerably better and it is considerably cheaper. And I am absolutely in love with Saint Elder elderflower liqueur.
So can I give you the one like my one house specialty favorite cocktail out of this book?
Yeah, absolutely.
It's a lion's tail. Comes out of the 1930s, and it is 2 ounces of bourbon, 3/4 ounce of allspice dram, which is you ever try that?
I haven't. I'm familiar with it, but I haven't sought it out. I've seen it a lot in a lot of tiki drinks.
It is, yeah. It shows up there mostly, and it's a pretty specialty sort of ingredient that doesn't fit a lot of things, and you wouldn't necessarily think that it would fit this, but it does. 2 ounces of bourbon, 3/4 ounce of allspice dram, 1/2 ounce of lime juice, The recipe here calls for half a tablespoon of simple syrup. I usually go with a little bit more, and two dashes of Angostura. And I think it is a fantastic drink.
Oh, that's cool. What's the bourbon you go with?
Kind of whatever I have at the moment. I've been using Maker's Mark as just a general mixing bourbon.
All right. I would disagree with that and go for the Wild Turkey personally.
I wouldn't say that you're necessarily wrong.
No, I'm just throwing my weight around. I like Maker's Mark is good, but I think it's a little pricey for what you get.
Okay. Well, I'm still working my way through a 1.75 that I got at Costco, which was not particularly pricey.
Yeah.
And in my mind, the allspice dram kind of kills a lot of the subtlety from other things. I don't know that I would put a really, really high end bourbon in this.
Yeah.
Cause I don't think you'd notice it. So.
Well, that's cool. Do you have any horror stories of drunks you had to deal with or?
I did get counterfeit money once. I got a counterfeit 100 from a guy. It was right after the Super Bowl, and he had apparently won like $700 betting on the Super Bowl in hundreds. And he tried to pay for his restaurant, you know, his bar tab with one. And this taught me a lesson that I still use to this day. We had that stupid little felt pen thing for finding counterfeit money at the register. That thing's worthless because what these bills were $5 bills that had been bleached and reprinted as hundreds. So the pen said it was legit because it was real money paper. But when you looked at it against a light, you got a watermark of Lincoln. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. I think I told him I had to get change from the back or something, gave it to the manager. The cops showed up pretty quick because we're in an airport and there's cops wandering around with nothing better to do. Turned out the guy had, like I said, like $700 on him. As far as anyone could tell, he had no idea it was counterfeit and was really quite unhappy when it was all confiscated from him.
Someone had probably screwed him on that Super Bowl bet.
Exactly. Yeah, I'm sure that's what had happened. But that taught me to I check hundreds when I get them and 50s. And the way I check them is always by looking at the watermark, not by using a stupid counterfeit pen.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of an interesting story. I've never had to deal with that in my bar, or maybe I have, and just nobody noticed they were fake bills. But that is great. And I always wanted to hear. When I heard that you worked as a bartender, I'm like, oh, is he going to tell me? Wait, tell the story. So I decided to shoot you an email and say, hey, man, can you tell the story for everybody?
So the one other cool aspect to this story, I think, is. When I started this job, I moved to Phoenix and got myself this garage door gig because out of college, I moved out to some property in the total middle of nowhere in Arizona with big plans to build an off-grid house, which I did eventually do. But what I found is in this little dinky town, I could not make enough money to, you know, buy food and gas and make any progress on building a house and pay a student loan bill. And I figured if I was going to make this happen, I had to get rid of the damn student loans. So that's what took me to Phoenix and ultimately got me a bartending job. And I set up my finances while I was bartending so that I took, I think it was like $50 a day for living expenses, rent, car, food, that stuff. Ate at Chili's a lot for 3 years, by the way. The pocket change that I brought home, because, you know, we got coins as tips regularly. That was my play money. Like, that was the gun fund. Mm-hmm. And I used that at the time I was buying and selling a lot of parts kits because that was kind of the heyday of cool AK parts kits. And then everything else that I made went into an envelope. And every time the envelope hit $1,000, I would take it down to the post office and send a $1,000 money order to Sally Mae. And it took me a year, but I paid off the student loan doing it. And once I finished that, like, now, okay, I've got this pretty decently paying job. I'm established now in Phoenix. You know, I've got an apartment that I've been living in for a long time. I know stuff. I know people. Like, I don't have to turn around and go back out into the middle of nowhere, but I decided that I really did want to make this house happen. And in order to do that, I needed to have a big chunk of money to pay for a well, to pay for a solar system, to pay for construction materials, all that sort of stuff. And so I made the decision to keep doing the exact same budget, and I did it for another 2 years and ended up with, it's like $80,000 in cash, which, by the way, at one point, after about a year of that, I started to get kind of freaked out by the amount of money sitting in a shoebox in my apartment closet and went and got a safe deposit box. But I ended up giving my manager, I think, 11 months notice that I was quitting, because I looked at it, I'm like, this has been reliably predictable for 2 years. I'm pretty confident that I know exactly what I'll make for the next year. And the building season starts in like April when it's warm enough. So I think it was June or something. I told my manager, by the way, next April, I'm quitting. And she was like, yeah, whatever. And next April, on the day, I'm like, I'm out. And moved back up to the property.
Wait, did you walk out on April 1st?
No, I don't remember the exact date, but
because if you did it on April 1st, it was one of those, she probably still think you were joking.
She had bet me $20 that I wouldn't actually leave, and I never did get the $20, which I found a little annoying. But yeah, I've had people, when they find out about that house project, a lot of people want to know, like, how do you do that? Well, the answer is, you just do it. One foot in front of the other, and every little bit of progress is a step forward.
Well, that's awesome. Well, thank you so much for coming on the show, Ian. And we all look forward to seeing your next videos on YouTube and all the other off-location places where they are.
Well, thank you very much.
Weird, I am disappointed that you did not make a joke, a reference, or anything about Gun Jesus turning water into wine.
Ooh, you know what? It didn't even occur to me.
For shame.
Yeah.
So here's another for shame moment, although you could surprise me. I would really like to know more about that off-grid house he built. I don't suppose he talked more about it and you just cut it for time?
So there will be a little bit of talk on it in the in an upcoming blooper reel, because
okay. There
was some stuff, but it wasn't. I did ask him, do you want to talk a little bit more about that? And he's just like, I've kind of been off it a little bit. He wasn't comfortable. He didn't feel he was expert enough to really be talking about all the stuff in the off-grid house. But I do have in the show notes a video of him giving a tour of his house while it was under construction. So it's actually pretty interesting. But yeah, it's an all solar powered house.
Well, I mean, that makes sense if he lives in Arizona, which I didn't know until now.
Oh yeah, you didn't know that?
No.
You didn't notice the fact that when he's out shooting in the desert for the Forgotten Weapons videos, that there's all those saguaros?
Saguaros?
Yeah, the cactus that looked like the
saguaro.
Yeah.
Okay. So here's the thing, and I can't explain how I thought this, but I actually thought he lived in New England. I think it's because at one point when I watched Forgotten Weapons, I got the impression that the auction house was up there in New England.
There was one. It's since closed down, but it was the James Julia Auction House is actually right near where Ryan Machad lives. I believe it was in Fairfield, Maine. But yeah, it's in the James Julia Auction House was in central Maine, and so he would go up twice a year to there.
Okay, see, this makes sense, and I just had things reversed. Apparently, he was living in Arizona and flying up to Maine to do Forgotten Weapons. I thought he lived in Maine and then flew to the desert to do those videos. Mm-hmm. I'm not crazy! Hurrah!
No, you're not crazy. And yeah, he is the globe-traveling type. So yeah, it was definitely I contacted him. He says, yeah, sounds like fun. I just said, you know what? Let's talk about something that isn't old French guns. Let's talk about tending bar. And, oh God, it was just, oh, did I laugh hard when I realized that he worked at a Chili's bar? Cause that was exactly what I expected was I want Ian to tell a story of him being as a bartender and having it not be a glamorous story, because people say, weird, oh my gosh, you make such good cocktails and you're so excited about all of that. you know what? You should see if you can like get like one shift a week at a bar. Like it just seems like it would be, you're wasting your skills just, you know, mixing drinks for yourself and your friends. And I'm just like, no, I've worked as a bartender. It means you're making lots of gin and tonics and rum and cokes and other entirely boring drinks. And like Ian said, making margaritas for people and going, you know what? I can make you a real margarita that actually uses fresh juice and quality ingredients. And they go, ugh, it's not good because they're used to drinking high fructose corn syrup.
Well, weird. I prefer Cuba Libre.
Oh, yes. For the rum and cokes. Oh, maybe someday Cuba will be free.
See, that was the joke because you mentioned making rum and cokes, and then no, I'm all fancy. Mm-hmm. I call it a Cuba Libre.
Or that scene from Cocktail in from the Tom Cruise movie Cocktail. What's in that?
I never saw that movie, so
I haven't seen it since it was like fresh out, and I was amused of it back then, but I was young and very stupid. So I've heard it's one of the worst movies ever made.
And now the difference is you're no longer young. Heyo!
Thanks to each and every one of our listeners, and a very special thanks to all our supporters on Patreon. To become a Patreon patron, go to patreon.com/assortedcaliberspodcast to sign up. Patrons get an early release of the podcast, plus bonus content like our hilarious blooper reels, the ACP film tracks, and the ACP mag dump.
Also, please remember to rate us on Apple Podcasts. Subscribe to us on the platform of your choice, and share the show with your friends, both online and off.
You can get more from me at my blog, which is weirdworld.com. That's weerdworld.com. And hear me weekly on Handgun Radio on the Firearms Radio Network.
.com. Yeah, you know where to find me. And since this is usually my freestyle moment, so people wanted to know about Subscribestar. And it's not happening because I tried to get things to work and it didn't. And I eventually browbeat Weird into looking it up. And apparently they actually won't host audio. They've got like this really stupidly low limit and they want you to like post a YouTube link or some other thing. So we aren't going to do that. We understand that there are people who don't like Patreon, and we are investigating alternate sources. But yeah, Subscribestar isn't going to happen. Sorry, gang.
Yeah, they're essentially just a payment gateway. So they are able to take money and send money and allow people to control access to the content that you want to give them, but the content must come from elsewhere. And at that point in time, you know what? We'll do it ourselves. But unfortunately, for us to do it ourselves, it is going to take time and ingenuity. And that is, there's a lot of that ingenuity does not belong to any of the direct staff of ACP. So we are seeking people to help us build out our website so that we can be free of Patreon and just essentially be full controllers of our product.
So coming soon, PM.
Thanks to Nate Spencer for our music.
Well, because he interviewed Gun Jesus, that must make him Gun Peter. And I guess that makes me Gun Mary Magdalene. Our various biblical personalities are assorted. Oh, I'm going to hell for this. And so is our podcast. Good night, everybody. Is it warm in here or is it just me?
Oh my God! Oh my God, I'm done!